Is it time for a podcast already?
Check 1 2, check 1 2, check 1 2, check 1 2.
I go to your seat, lady, cause this one's a screamer.
I didn't know that.
Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of the Garlic Jar Podcast Show. On today's episode, we are just going to get right down to business. Tonight with me, I have Matt, as usual, and tonight we are bringing back Sean, and we have also a special guest joining Sean, the one, the only, Nate the Great. How's everybody doing tonight?
Doing good. What's up, everybody?
How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. Nate, we're excited to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on and hanging out with us for an hour, buddy.
Yeah, we always hear a lot about this Nate the Great, you know, and I think we've even dropped it a bunch of times on our podcast shows there, especially here with Sean and everything like that. I mean, yeah, I'm excited. I want to see what's going on with Nate the Great.
Well, we got him, buddy. He did some research and he's
awesome.
Ready to
what do you guys
go.
Have in store for us today?
Well, we're going to talk Martin Luther King. Nate's gonna talk about civil rights, poverty, and the Vietnam War.
Important things
as far as King, and I'm gonna talk about the assassination, and I'm gonna talk about COINTELPRO.
Yeah, that works. So who wants to go first?
Well, you know what? Before we get into King, though, I do want to tell a quick story on JFK and RFK because
we love
it's
stories.
Important. Well, you know, we talked about. This Oliver Stone movie that's coming out, the documentary, and all of a sudden all the disinformation creatures are out of the woodwork. So, you know, all the stories are coming out, you know, and they're bashing Kennedy's this and that. So I just want to tell a story that a lot of information's coming out. In 1959, public schools in Virginia started to close. And what happened was there was a Prince Edward County in Virginia where there was like over 2,000 students, mostly poor, mostly black, had nowhere to go to school. So JFK was a senator. He tried to get some action in the Senate and stuff, but you know, let's face it, the Southern Democrats and Republicans, they wanted no part of that. So they didn't do anything. He really couldn't make any moves until he became president. And then when he became president, he put RFK in charge. And RFK started to fight this in the courts. And it was a losing battle. So what happened was, now it's late 1962, and JFK and RFK brainstormed, and they said, you know what? So we got a lot of money. We got a lot of rich friends. Why don't we build this whole school district from scratch? And so what they did is they called their friend of theirs, William Vanderhoevel, and he was an attorney. And he said, they told him, they said, listen, we need you to start raising some money. We're going to put in some money, and we're going to build this entire school district. And Vanderhoevel said, what do you mean? He said, everything. We're going to rent the buildings. We're going to build a elementary center, kindergarten, middle school, high school. We're going to hire the teachers, hire the counselors. We're going to get the buses. We're going to do everything. We're going to build this school district from scratch. And Vanderhoevel was all in. And what they did is they raised the money and they did it. And RFK was center in this. He took charge of it. And I really think, I don't know how RFK ever slept. Like, I really don't think he ever slept, because he was like Kennedy's right, JFK's right hand in everything. He was, you know, and here he is. He's even involved in the hiring the teacher process. It is. And can you imagine, like, he a year earlier, he's involved in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and here he is hiring teachers. But anyway, they built this school. They built it from scratch, and they got the whole school running, and over 2,000 students. And it was such a great school that there was students that were rich white students that wanted to go to the school because the teachers were top class. It was just excellent. And then after JFK is assassinated, what the students did is they raised. They all got pennies, and they raised 10,000 pennies, and they presented to RFK in 1964 when he came to the school, and they said, this is for the future JFK library that they built in Boston.
That's nuts.
Wow.
So that's just a great story. You know what I mean? Like, it's something that you don't hear. Like, you hear too much about all this other. Like I said, the creatures are out of the woodwork. So the next time you hear something on, you know, old man Kennedy drinking beers with Bugs Moran and Al Capone, you know what I mean? Think about this story yep. here. Because that's just an amazing story.
Well, you know, I mean, too, I think it's just, it's a nice social move. It's a nice community move, too. I mean, especially, I mean, when you say 10,000 pennies, right? So that's $100 right there. And I mean, I think just the moral premise of that, the purpose is like that, you know, that $100 is meaningful to get a start. It's a, you know, and
well, that's
and,
what it was. It was just all about the presentation.
And I like that. You know? That's a, to me, that's defining a big start, you know? Especially coming from the kids.
Yeah, definitely. So that's it on JFK. I just wanted to get that out because, like I said, watch out for the creatures because they're out there. They're all over the media.
Oh, man. Well, we know that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're going to get into to MLK now. And I'm going to turn it over to Nate the Great. And we're going to start on civil rights. Go ahead, Nate.
Okay, so MLK and the civil rights, he advanced through the civil rights with nonviolence because he didn't want to hurt anyone because he was just trying to make peace. So he participated and led marches for black people and the right to vote, the segregation, labor rights, and other civil rights. He also organized the 1963 March on Washington. And about the 1963 March on Washington, JFK approved the march, and RFK also supervised the march. And for all the hard work MLK did, in 1964, he won the Nobel Peace Prize.
He did.
Now, all that's important because what this did was this got King on the radar of J. Edgar Hoover. So J. Edgar Hoover now, you know, because let's face it, he was a racist, but he also really believed that the Communist Party, the Communists have infiltrated the civil rights movement. So King is really on the radar of Hoover. And this is where I'm going to talk about in a little bit the COINTELPRO program. The next step, King does two other things that puts him on the radar of the 1%, and then the radar of the national security structure. So I'm going to give it back to Nate for the second thing that King was involved in. Go ahead, Nathan.
So King was also involved in the Poverty Poor People's Campaign. It was very big of an effort to gain economic justice for all poor people in the U.S. It demanded economic and human rights for... for everyone. They set up a 3,000-person protest campaign at the Washington, D.C. Mall for 2 weeks.
Okay.
And see, here's the important thing. When he says everyone, he's talking about not just black people. He's talking about white people, poor white people. He's talking about Latino, Asian, everybody. You know, poverty was a serious thing, and it went across all Americans.
Right, right. And that's important, too. Now, which one was that? That was the Poverty Act?
No, this was the Poor People's Campaign.
People, okay.
This is what Martin Luther King, yeah. This is what he was working on. Now, he set up that the 3,000 persons that protested the camp, but there was also something else that he had planned. Go ahead, Nate. Tell him about that.
So MLK also had planned that 500,000 people, but before he could do it, he was assassinated.
Now think about that. Now think about 500,000 people protesting, and it wasn't just protesting, but they were setting up tents, and they were like homeless people, mm-hmm. you know. So they'd be setting up tents all over Washington. 500,000 people, you know, 500,000
right.
people.
Wow.
And see, this is what this put him on the radar of the 1%, because this when King's talking about the distribution of wealth, this really this is something that the ruling class doesn't want to hear. So now he's not only on the radar of Hoover, he's on the radar of the 1%.
Okay.
And we're talking about the 1%. You know who I'm talking
yeah.
about, Rockefeller.
Yes. The rich, the powerful, the wealthy.
Times.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, right, and I mean, I could see that. That's something that, to me, I mean, I could just think of it. That's not in their wheelhouse to entertain, you know.
And see, poverty. I mean, it was such a big thing. Nate, go into some of the statistics on poverty.
So in 1968, it was estimated that 60 million Americans, which was 33% of the U.S. population, live below the poverty line.
Holy smokes.
I mean, think about that. Think about that.
That's a lot of people.
Oh, it's too many people for, you know, United States of America.
You're talking a third. A third of the percentage of population.
Exactly.
33%.
Exactly. So now, like I said, he's on the radar of Hoover, and he's on the radar to 1%. But then the biggest thing is yet to come, and this puts him on the national security radar. This puts him with people like you know who, Alan Dulles and Richard Helms. This puts him on their radar, and Nate's going to talk about that, and that'll be the Vietnam War. So go ahead, Nate.
Other civil rights activists wanted MLK to stay silent on the war because they didn't want him to say anything, because obviously.
Well, what they were afraid of is that Johnson would turn on him, you know, and that's exactly what he did. But the thing is, we'll talk about Johnson later. He was never on MLK's side to begin with, you know, but Nate's right. Like other civil rights activists, they did not want King to come out against the Vietnam mm-hmm. War.
Makes sense.
But in April 1967, he came out against the Vietnam War. He delivered a speech, and that speech was called Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence.
And see, this is important because that speech, right, a year to the date of that speech that he gave is when King was assassinated. And you can't tell me that that's a coincidence.
No, for sure.
Yeah, that's a little fishy.
You know? And what really put King over the edge was there was an article in Ramparts magazine about what was going on in Vietnam, and they had pictures of kids that were being slaughtered in the villages that were being slaughtered, and King saw the pictures and he just started crying and he said, I can't stay silent
right.
anymore.
And you know, I think too, I mean, just to kind of give a little insight there, you know, I like that you guys actually mentioned this, because you know, I feel like with a lot of people, when you dig into Martin Luther King, everybody just remembers and they go back to that one speech, you know, I Have a Dream. And of course, I mean, that's
sure.
monumental. I mean,
that's the big
you know,
one, of
it
course.
Is.
That, exactly. It's the I to my to me in my day, I look at that as one of the granddaddy speeches in our all-time history.
Mm-hmm.
And but I mean, there's been other speeches, and I mean, I like the fact that you guys bring that up, because a lot of people probably don't realize that, maybe know that Martin Luther King had more memorable speeches to know about, you know?
Well, this is true, and the thing is, he really went after, you know, the Johnson administration on the Vietnam War. Nate's going to talk a little bit more about the specifics
yeah.
on it now. So go ahead, Nate.
He said the USA was in Vietnam to occupy it as a colony, not to free anyone.
And that's a good point, too, because, I mean, really, Matt, we talked about this before. Like, what was the initiative over there? There was
yeah.
no initiative. Like, who were we freeing over there?
He called the USA the greatest purveyor of violence in the whole world.
I mean,
wow.
think about that. Think about what he just said. And you know what? I mean, with the things that I talked about, what Alan Dulles was doing and Rockefeller, what they were doing in the Third World, what they were doing in Africa. I mean, and could you really argue with him? I mean,
yep.
you know what I mean?
He connected the world with economic injustice, arguing that the country needed serious moral change. It took money and resources that could be spent on social welfare. He accused the government of killing 1 million Vietnamese,
wow.
mostly children.
Wow.
Yeah, and it keep the end part, mostly children. I mean, there was a lot. Because remember, they're over there, they're bombing nothing. I mean, they're bombing villages. It's not like there's, like, army bases and stuff.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then Nixon would make it worse. He's, you know, he's bombing Laos and Cambodia. But, you know, the whole Rolling Thunder campaign, I mean, they were bombing everything. They were bombing jungle and the villages. And, you know, a lot of innocent people were getting killed. And then the other thing is the Phoenix program that we're going to talk about that was, you know, the CIA's assassination program in Vietnam was supposed to target the Viet Cong. It was targeting a lot of innocent civilians were getting slaughtered in that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Wow.
So Nate did a good job there. He did a lot of research, you know, as far as the background on King. So now, you know, you have Hoover. You have Rockefeller, you have Dulles, and you have Helms, all bent on getting rid of King, you know? So what I want to talk about is I want to talk about COINTELPRO.
Okay.
Now, this was the FBI's program to basically discredit any organization that geared to the left that they felt was a national security threat. And wait till you hear some of the organizations they targeted, and tell me how they're a security threat. Now, obviously, the civil rights movement was high on that list. They had American Indian movement, environmentalist groups, animal right organizations, all feminist groups, including women's right to vote, Puerto Rican independence groups like the Young Lords. I mean, you know, groups that wanted a united Ireland. Could somebody explain to me, though, how a women's right to vote group is a national security threat? And it's one of the groups that's not on that list is the Ku Klux Klan, which is unbelievable. Like, if you're going to have a group that's a national security threat, how do you not have the Klan on there? You know, and it wasn't until really Bobby Kennedy, as Attorney General, pressured him that the FBI really went after the Klan. You know, it was RFK who pressured him. It wasn't Hoover, you know? So that was the COINTELPRO program. And the thing is, when we get to the Manson episode, we're going to talk about the CIA's version of that, which was called Chaos, Operation Chaos. And they were doing the same thing. They were after the same groups, and they were targeting these groups. You know, they were attacking these groups, in every way possible, and it was all illegal. It was illegal wiretaps. They were opening up the mail of individuals that were on the list, which was totally illegal, and they were also sending in infiltrators, and the infiltrators would go in, and they would try to organize riots. They would try to, you know, cause dissension inside the ranks of these organizations, so they were trying to totally dismantle these organizations.
Okay.
You know, and it's like, it's amazing when you look at that list, like, you know, where is the national security threat on most of those groups?
I got a question for Nate, though, if you don't mind me asking, Sean.
I got a question
for Nate. So, Nate.
Yep. Let me bring him.
Go ahead. So, Nate, my question is, so looking at Martin Luther King Jr., is he one of your favorite, I don't want to say character.
Not a character.
He
yeah.
is definitely not a character. I'm thinking, here I am going back to movies now. No, but I want to ask you, is he one of your favorite and memorable people, like persons in history? Do you like Martin Luther King Jr.? Is he one of your favorites to study?
Yes, of course, because he was very fascinating from the start, because since he wanted to not necessarily stop the Vietnam War, but he was speaking out against it.
Well, no, you were right, Nate. You were right. He wanted to stop the Vietnam War. He definitely wanted to stop, and he definitely had that influence where he was a threat to do that, and that's why he was on the radar, these guys like Dulles and Helms,
for sure.
Who were over there who wanted the Vietnam War.
Because King criticized it. I mean, he was one of the most controversial and lost supporters of that political part of Vietnam.
And you know the interesting thing about this, Matt? And I don't know if Nate even knows this. I don't know if he did this, if he came across this on his research. But when Martin Luther King came out against the Vietnam War, his approval rating was down that 63%. Of people polled had a non-favorable view of Martin Luther King.
Can that's crazy.
Like they taught, you know, and Hoover was spreading the word that he was a yep. traitor, and that's what a lot of people thought at the time. Because remember, people were not getting the information that we have now that was going on yep. in Vietnam, and they were spreading the word that everything. Because remember, I talked about the Post with Tom Hanks. And how they had Katharine Graham was spreading it through the Washington Post that everything's going good in Vietnam, and Johnson's having writing articles and having her publish them, and things are going great, and we're freeing the people over there. You know what I mean? So a lot of people will actually believe that.
Oh, definitely.
So when he speaks out against the war, people are like, well, why is he doing this? Yep. You know what I mean? Because they really didn't understand.
And I mean, I just want to share with you, too. I mean, I ask you that question, Nate, because Martin Luther King Jr. is one of my favorites. I mean, I won't sit back and I won't, you know, I won't zip it. I mean, because once we start talking about Martin Luther King, I mean, I could get vocal on him too. I mean, I love this guy in history. I think there's been so many defining moments, and it was a shame because it just ended too soon. This guy could have been the catapult of many years ahead. And I still think that to this day, he's probably the lost voice that we all needed to hear years after everything going on.
Yeah.
So, I love Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King.
And definitely, and you know, Nathan does too. Nathan did some great research on him, but he's definitely one yep. of his idols.
So, that's great. Good job, Nate. I like it. I like the stats and I like the research. Keep it up, man.
Yeah, you're doing a good job, buddy.
Thank you.
So, now I want to get into my area, which, of course, is assassination. So, you know, I talked about this before because, remember, Nate asked that great question on one of our earlier podcasts about Martin Luther King, and I talked about the civil trial. 1999, Martin Luther King's family sued a man by the name of Lloyd Jowers and the United States government for complicity to assassinate Martin Luther King, and they won. They won. So think about that. And there was no mainstream reporters in the room, the entire trial. Could you imagine that? I mean, well, because let's face it, they were told to stand down. They were told to stand down. You know, and think about, you know, O.J. Simpson trial only a few years earlier. I mean, how many reporters covered that? It was on night and day. You know, so, I mean, that's just, you know, it's mind-boggling to me. But there was a local writer, Jim Douglas. He wrote some tremendous books. He wrote a great book, JFK and the Unspeakable. I mean, that's a tremendous book. But he was in the courtroom every day, so he followed the trial. So basically what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to talk about everything that was from the trial off of actual transcripts. So some of this is actually unbelievable. So when you hear this, this is not conspiracy theories. This is not stuff you get on YouTube. This is witnesses that were at the civil trial that testified under oath, and remember, they got a guilty verdict. Now, you also remember in the civil trial, you know, the proof is not as strong. Like, you don't have to have, the evidence doesn't have to be as strong as in a criminal trial to convict. You know what I'm saying? The burden of proof. But I mean, the evidence that came out in this trial was absolutely unbelievable, and it shows you the conspiracy that I talked about with all the forces that were against King. And it started off, you know, I think with the fact that Hoover had the COINTELPRO program, and it was our friend William Sullivan, who we talked about a lot on this show. You know, he was trying to discredit Martin Luther King. And one of the things is, you know, we talked about him and JFK and RFK, that they were, none of them were perfect. Nobody's perfect. Well, the fact is that Martin Luther King did have affairs. I mean, that's something that, you know, people don't want to necessarily talk about. You know, they kind of talk a little bit more with JFK, but it is a fact that he did have affairs outside of marriage. And the thing is, Martin Luther King was under surveillance from the COINTELPRO program. And Sullivan had audio tapes of these affairs, and he gave it to Hoover. And what Hoover did is, and this is unbelievable, but Hoover had a letter presented, and they sent it to King with all the evidence that they had of all these affairs, and they basically told him, if you don't want this released, what you could do is you could commit suicide. Wow. And then we won't release it. Could you imagine that? This is coming from J. Edgar Hoover, the you know, the head of the FBI. He told Martin Luther King in a letter, you know. But what happened was all the COINTELPRO, the whole process trying to discredit King, it didn't work. It didn't work, you know. And what Hoover did is he realized that, you know, he was going to need another way to get rid of King. So what he did is when he gets Helms involved, he writes up a report that's showing that Martin Luther King is a national security threat. And he gives it to Richard Helms, who's now the director of the CIA. We talked about Helms a lot during the Watergate episode. He was Alan Dulles' guy that he mentored for the job to take over. And you got to understand, when this report comes across Helms' desk, labeling King as a national security threat, anybody that came across Richard Helms as a national security threat ended up either assassinated or removed from office. And we could go down the whole list. We could talk about Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, Allende in Chile, Mossadegh in Iran. I mean, we talked about all these, you know what I mean? So Hoover knows when he's labeling King as a national security mm-hmm. threat and giving that to Richard Helms, he knows what's going to happen. You know right. what I'm saying? So let's get into the actual trial testimony. So there was different layers to this conspiracy. There was a local conspiracy, and then there was a broader conspiracy. You know, but it's going to involve Army intelligence. It's going to involve the CIA, the FBI, the Memphis police. I mean, this was a massive conspiracy, and it goes to show you it was similar to Dallas. You know, that they were not going to let King out of Memphis. You know, so anyway, the local conspiracy was, we all know the story that James L. Ray, you know, was arrested for the murder of Martin Luther King. Well, a guy by the name of Lloyd Jowers, a local business owner, he came forward in the late 90s, and he came out, and this is who the family sued, and he says he was approached by a mafia-connected produce dealer by the name of Frank Liberto. Now, Frank Liberto worked for Carlos Marcello, and we talked about Marcello, and he was very, remember in the last mob episode I talked about how Marcello was connected to Army mm-hmm. intelligence? Well, I mean, I think, to be honest with you, I think his name was thrown out there because CIA always likes to throw the mob into everything, you know what I mean? But anyway, he says, Jowers says that he was approached by Liberto to set up this meeting, and at the meeting was officer by the name of Merrill McCullough. Now, we talked about Merrill McCullough when Nate asked that question on the one episode. Merrill McCullough was an intelligence officer undercover into a group called the Invaders, which was like an imitation Black Panthers. And he was the guy that helped have the hotel room changed. He was the guy in the picture, the famous picture that's pointing at where James L. Ray, you know, supposedly shot from. And Merrill McCullough would retire from the CIA with high honors. So he was an intelligence officer from day one. So Merrill McCullough's at this meeting. A Memphis Police Intelligence Lieutenant Earl Clark, who was also the best sniper in the Memphis Police, and two men that were in suits that he assumed were CIA. Okay? And also at this meeting was a man by the name of Raul. Now, Raul was the guy that James L. Ray said that always set him up, was Raul. And we're going to talk about him in a little bit because he was identified at the trial. So what happened was Jowers said that after the assassination, he took the rifle from Lieutenant Earl Clark, who he believes was the actual sniper, and then he gave it to Raul. And they got rid of it, but they dropped the evidence, the actual rifle that they were setting up James L. Ray with, and they left it outside Jim's Grill, which is the place that Jowers owned. Okay, so a lot of stuff was going on that came out at the trial. There was a fire station that was directly across from the Lorraine Motel where King was assassinated. And the day before the assassination, there was only two members of the fire department that were Black, and they were sent home. One was by the name of Floyd Newsom, who was actually also a civil rights activist. And he was told that he was sent home and he was going to get a temporary transfer. Okay? Now, there was also another black detective in the Memphis Police Department. Okay? And he was, his name was Eddie Redder. And he was transferred. He was sent home because he had always, every time that Martin Luther King had come to Memphis, he had supplied the security detail. Okay? So now the black fireman and the black police detective, they're all sent home. So it also came out that Army intelligence had set up surveillance, and they've taken over the fire department after they sent these people home. And they set up watch, and they were, and Martin Luther King was under 24-hour surveillance at the Lorraine Motel. Okay? So now, the room that James L. Ray supposedly fired from, okay, it was a boarding house that was directly across from there. Now think about this. You're talking about he fired from a public bathroom. Now, you're a sniper. Why would you choose a public bathroom? Anybody could walk in, okay? And if you look at that, he actually would have to stand on a bathtub, now the outside of a bathtub, to set up the rifle outside the window. And think about it, like, there's no evidence that he was actually a professional sniper to have the balance to do that. But here's the interesting thing. One of the detectives that testified at the civil trial said that there was a tree that was, the branch of the tree was actually in that window of the public bathroom that was blocking all the view. And the next day, the Memphis Public Works Department, on orders from the Memphis Police Department, cut that tree branch down, okay? And they also, the next day, they cut down the bushes from across the Lorraine Motel where people actually witnessed the actual sniper. Where they actually think the actual sniper fired a shot. He was concealed in bushes, and then the next day the bushes were cut down. So, I mean, think about that. I mean, that's just unbelievable. And all this came out at the trial, you know? So, then you had Raul. So, Raul, who James O'Reilly always said set him up, okay? It came out at the trial that he was a guy by the name of Raul Caiello, who was a Portuguese intelligence officer working for the CIA. And guess who he was recruited into intelligence work by? Alan Dulles. Yeah. You know, and Raul was the guy that set James O'Reilly up. He because James O'Reilly actually, before the assassination, I don't know if you guys noticed, but he escaped from a Missouri prison.
No, wow.
And yeah, and he fled to Canada. Okay, and he was.
I was just going to say this.
And he was a petty criminal. He was a petty
criminal. I think this. Yeah, this sounds like. Because I remember reading up on that. So Raul would be the mystery man from Montreal.
Yes, the mystery man from Montreal. Yep. Yes, man. And that's what. And he's the one that set him up. So he would be. Like, think about the Kennedy, the JFK case, when Oswald had all these handlers. Like, he had George de Mornschild in the Paines moving him around. Raul would be that. He would be his intelligence handler. Moving James L. Ray around, you know, and it's interesting that Ray was using the name Eric Galt, who was an intelligence officer with NSA credentials. So, you know, if he was ever picked up, he would have the identification of Eric Galt. People would run that, and they would see NSA and let him go. So, I mean, here's a guy, a petty criminal, is not going to be able to get that, you know, without help. And Raul was the guy that was definitely helping him. So, before we get to the broad, well, you know what? Let me get to the broader conspiracy. Then I'm going to get into some of the other evidence. But the broader conspiracy was that Captain Whedon in a fire station, you know, like I said before, he said two Army intelligence officers wanted to look out for the Lorraine Motel, so, and he testified under oath that they took over. They were on the roof, and they were. 24-hour surveillance on King. Now, another guy that testified was a researcher by the name of Doug Valentine. Now, Doug Valentine was doing work on the Phoenix program. You know, the Phoenix program, we talked about it, was the CIA's assassination program in Vietnam. And he said that a lot of veterans from that program were deployed from Vietnam to the government's anti-war movement, which would go into the COINTELPRO, because one of the things COINTELPRO was after was the anti-war movement. And he said also he found out that the 111th Military Intelligence Group out of Memphis also had King under 24-hour surveillance. And they took pictures of the assassination. They had the entire assassination under pictures, their videos and everything of it. But the most explosive testimony that came out at the trial was from a CIA operative by the name of Jack Terrell. Jack Terrell was Special Forces, and he was a whistleblower in the Iran-Contra hearing. But he was dying of liver cancer, and he wanted to get this off his chest. And he testified that his best friend, J.D. Hill, who was killed under suspicious circumstances, who was also a CIA officer and a Special Forces, he was a black operator, you know. Terrell said that J.D. Hill confessed to him that he's been a member of a 184 Alpha Delta Army sniper unit. And they were in Memphis. They were in Memphis that day to shoot an unknown target, okay? And they had practiced a triangulated crossfire, okay? And the snipers had taken up posts on a water tower and two other buildings. And then the orders came down that their target was Martin Luther King. And remember, this is an Army Delta sniper unit. And this is transcript coming out at the trial that they were there to assassinate King. Now, they were the backup team, because what had happened is Hill had told Terrell that when the shot was fired and King was down, that they were called off. So they were obviously the contingency plan. So like I said before, there was no way that Martin Luther King was getting out of Memphis. And you know, here's the testimony that came out about this Alpha Delta 184 sniper team. It was Operation Detachment, Special Forces Field Training Team, okay? And they were in civilian disguise, and the unit consisted of a captain, a second lieutenant, two staff sergeants, two buck sergeants, and two corporals. Now, this isn't, you know, something you're getting on YouTube. This is actual testimony at a civil trial. So this is under oath. This is coming out. Now, the government had later said that Alpha Team was in Memphis. They admitted it was in Memphis, but they said it was there for riot control. But come on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Wow.
So, I mean, that was the most... And you know what? There was actually more explosive testimony. There was a transcript released from the FBI from J. Edgar Hoover. And it was from the sealed records from the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And we talked about that a lot. But 3 weeks before the MLK assassination, Hoover had a series of meetings with Richard Helms at the CIA and the military intelligence group that I talked about out of Memphis and members of the Phoenix program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And now we have testimony that the Phoenix program and this intelligence group was in Memphis. And we know that Hoover told Helms that King was a national security threat. So, obviously, there was something to this meeting 3 weeks before the assassination. And there was also another explosive testimony that MLK actually survived the attack. He survived the shot. And they took him to a hospital, okay? And the hospital was, the doctor that was in the hospital was from the Atkins family. Now, the Atkins is like the Dixie Mafia. Russell Atkins was, he was a KKK member. He was a 32-degree Mason. And he was also the superintendent in the Memphis Public Works, who ordered the bushes cut down, who ordered the branch that was in James L. Ray's, the window that he supposedly fired from, cut down. Okay, and Russell Atkins' doctor was the one that was in the hospital when Martin Luther King was brought in, and Nate could tell you what happened there, because this is absolutely unbelievable. And this is testimony from the civil trial. Okay.
Wow, okay.
So Nate, tell them what happened to...
So, Martin Luther King survived the gunshot wound and was brought to the hospital, and like Sean stated, the doctor was from the Akin family, and like he said, they were
involved in the Dixie Mafia, but they were involved with J. Edgar Hoover. And what did they do? What did the doctor do? According to testimony from three witnesses now.
So according from the testimony of three witnesses, Martin Luther King was smothered in his hospital bed.
With a pillow.
Wow.
With a pillow by the doctor.
Could you imagine that? I mean, this is three witnesses. I believe two was nurses and another doctor that was there. Testified at the civil trial. I mean, this is explosive stuff. This is unbelievable. And the thing is, no reporter is in the courtroom.
Right.
I mean, can you believe this stuff? And you know what, William Pepper, who was the lawyer for James L. Ray, he had a great quote. He said, you know, all these years after Memphis, we now know that the same government that honors Dr. King today is the same government that killed
him. Right.
I mean, think about that statement. I mean, this is just unbelievable. And one of the other things that came out, are you guys familiar with Judge Joe Brown?
I'm not, no.
You're not? Well, you know Judge Judy, right?
Joe Brown, the TV show?
Joe Brown,
okay.
The TV show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Judge Joe Brown was the, before he had the TV show, he was the judge at James L. Ray when James L. Ray was trying to get his conviction overturned.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yes. And Judge Joe Brown was people didn't know it, but he was an expert gunman. I mean, he knew everything about guns. And what he realized is that the weapon that they had, okay, wasn't the weapon that they had was not the kill shot. It was not the rifle that killed Martin Luther King, and it was just like the Mannlicher Carcano in the JFK thing. And what happened was Judge Joe Brown ordered testing, okay? And he found that 70% of the bullets that were tested didn't match Ray's gun. And the other ones were inconclusive. So nothing matched that gun. So what happened was he was presiding over this, and this was the appeal to overturn the conviction, and then the entire city of Memphis comes down on him. The entire state comes down, and then the power of the federal government comes down on him. And Judge Joe Brown gets removed from the case, if you can imagine this, because they said he was not impartial, and he got removed from the case. And then, like a month later, while he's fighting this, he gets offered the TV show. So, you know what that was? That was, hey,
Keep
your mouth shut, and we'll give you this TV show. But here's the thing. Joe Brown took the TV show, but he didn't keep his mouth shut. He went on and he did his own investigation into what was going on here. And what happened was, you know, he started to make waves, kind of like Jim Garrison did with JFK. And then all of a sudden, his TV show gets canceled. He gets charged with contempt. I don't know if you remember this, Matt, but he actually spent a couple nights in jail. It's some kind of trumped up charge. I forget what it was, but something to do with one of the cases he was... had on the show, and he ended up he got contempt of court, and he spent a couple nights in jail, and then his show got canceled. You know, but the stuff that he did, because remember I said he was a gun guy, so what he did is his investigation said that the bullet that was pulled out of King had a different rate of rifling twist than the gun that Ray used, and also the weapon had a defect. Okay, that wasn't apparent on the death slug that was pulled out of Martin Luther King. Okay, and Judge Brown says that King was shot with KM-21 NATO caliber weapon with a modified telescopic sight. And his investigation has said it was modified by a company called Leatherwood, which was a government contractor used by the CIA quite a bit. And it used a special supersonic ammunition with a suppressor to reduce the velocity to below supersonic to confuse the sound so people wouldn't realize where the shot actually came from. Now think about that. Does that sound like a lone gunman? Or, I mean, you know, that's way above...
Sounds premeditated. Sounds like it's been organized.
Yeah. And again, this is all testimony that came out at the trial. I mean, this is at a civil trial. And again, I think, you know, when you break it down, you know, Nate brought up all the things. He brought up, you know, the civil rights movement puts King on the radar of J. Edgar Hoover. So Hoover goes after King with the COINTELPRO program. Then King goes the Poor People's Campaign. Now all of a sudden, the ruling class, the 1%, is after King. Okay? Then when he speaks out against the Vietnam War, now he's got the national security structure after him. And then when Hoover goes to Helms and said that, see, King is a national security threat, now Helms puts this plan in place, and it was a massive conspiracy. And the fact that no reporters were in the courtroom is just mind-boggling to me. I mean, where was ABC? Where was CBS? You know, where was NBC? Where was the Washington Post? You know, where is Tom Hanks?
Were they barred? Because the judge can bar reporters.
As far as
especially
I know,
like back in that time. No. Okay.
No, I know what you're saying, Jen, but no, because there was like I said, Jim Douglas was in the courtroom every single day. He was just a researcher,
right.
A writer. He was in the entire. He spent every day in the courtroom. He documented everything throughout the entire trial, and he was there every day. Nobody was barred.
Okay.
You know, this was a mandate from the top. I mean, I talked about this before. There's certain things that the ruling class and the national security state is not going to allow. And one of the things is looking into assassinations. They're just not going to allow it. And you know, when the this trial comes out, I mean, this should have been a headline in every paper and every news station all across the world. And it wasn't. You know, so it's just an amazing, you know, but the documents, you know, who was the actual sniper? A lot of the testimony, you know, from Lloyd Jowers, he says that Earl Clark was the actual sniper, who was a Memphis police intelligence lieutenant.
Mm.
And he was the best sniper in the department.
Okay.
And a lot of witnesses did see, you know, did feel that the shot came from the bushes directly across from the Lorraine Motel. And again, the next day, the bushes are cut down on orders from Russell Atkins, who's a supervisor in the Memphis Public Works. And they also cut down the branch that was blocking James L. Ray's shot. So, you know, there was a lot of good detectives. I don't want to make a bad, like it was all, because there were some really good Memphis police detectives that if they were left to their own devices, they would have solved this case. And one of them testified at the trial, and he said, you know, that branch was blocking James L. Ray's shot. He could not have shot from that public bathroom. It was a huge tree branch, and it was blocking the window. But the next day, it's cut down. Same thing with the bushes.
Yeah, that's a little weird. That's weird.
Yeah, well, it goes to show you the depths of the plot. You know, Army intelligence. I mean, they send all these, you know, the two firemen that were black, they sent them home. They sent the detective home. I mean, this is a massive plot. And again, it was a year to the day of the speech that Martin Luther King came out against the Vietnam War. And I don't think that was a coincidence.
You know, I think part of it, too, is, and I remember reading up on something about this, because, I mean, I can't remember the name of the guy, but I think it might have been the, maybe you mentioned it here, the owner of the tavern. Was it?
That was Jim's Grill. That was Lloyd Jowers. He's the guy that they sued. Because he came forward,
yeah.
So Martin Luther King's family.
Didn't he say
him,
that? Yep. I was going to say, didn't he say that there was a paid plan or something like, or he was paid? There was a paid plan for King's assassination or something like that.
Yes, and it was through this guy Liberto, but they set up this meeting where Merrill McCullough, who was the intelligence officer, Earl Clark, two CIA guys, they were all there at this meeting, and Raul Coelho, who was, you know, recruited by Alan Dulles. You know, they were all at this meeting, and that's what Lloyd Jowers said. And, you know, the indictment states that Lloyd Jowers and the United States government. So the actual judge in the trial said that he put 70% of the guilt on U.S. intelligence agencies and 30% of the guilt on Jowers. Think about that.
But that's who. So that's the guy who owns the tavern. And what was and
he owns so Jim's Grill. It was right in back of the.
So, do you think
Hotel.
He was paid off in the plan, though? Do you think?
Oh yeah, he was. He admitted. He admitted. He's the guy. He was given testimony, knowing that he's going to get sued. And here's the thing: the King family took a lot of heat for this trial. They sued for $1. So it had nothing to do with money. They sued for $1 in the civil trial.
They wanted closure. They wanted the answer.
Record what happened. Yes, they wanted closure. They wanted closure. So, yeah, but Jowers, you know, and Jowers was dying. He had stomach cancer, I think, or something like that, and he wanted to get it off his chest, just like, you know, this Jack Terrell, who was a black operator. He wanted to get it off his chest, so he testified, you know, that what he knew about that sniper unit that was in Memphis. You know, so the whole thing was just unbelievable. And again, it goes back to Hoover with the whole COINTELPRO program. And we're going to talk more about that when we're going to see when we go with the Manson episode and we talk about Operation Chaos. Like, there was an absolute directive to destroy the left wing in this country. There really was. And anybody who even geared from the middle, even slightly to the left, was targeted by Dulles, Helms, and Hoover. And they had millions of Americans under surveillance. And this was illegal surveillance. I mean, they didn't have the warrant for this. They didn't have, you know what I mean? And they were tapping people's phones. They were opening up their mail.
Right.
I mean, it's just
illegal activity.
And then you would see this more into with the Black Panthers when you know, what's his name? Hoover goes after the Black Panthers. You know, he really aggressively attacked them, you know, with the COINTELPRO program. You know, and you see that. I don't know if you guys seen the movie Judas and the Black Messiah.
No, I didn't.
No, I never saw that one.
Oh, but that's a really good movie about the Black Panthers. And it's definitely,
what's it called? Judas and the Black Messiah?
It's Judas and the Black Messiah, yes.
I'll have to put that on my list.
It's about Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton was a charismatic 22-year-old leader of the Chicago chapter of the Panthers.
I mean, you got some pretty heavy hitters in there, too. I mean, you got Jesse Plemons. You have Martin Sheen, Ashton Sanders. Yeah, it looks like a good cast.
Yeah. Oh, it's a tremendous movie. And the guy that plays Freddie Hampton was tremendous.
Daniel Kaluuya.
And if yes. And if you want to go, you know, get some speeches of Fred Hampton on YouTube, this guy was unbelievable, and he was 22 years old. And he was assassinated. I mean, there's no doubt about that. That was you'll see that in the movie. He was assassinated. And that was under directive of J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, this is a newer film too, from what I'm looking at here. So
it is.
I'll definitely have to check it out.
Yes,
it's a Hulu watch. It's on Hulu.
One thing I want to mention about COINTELPRO, we would not even know about this if it wasn't for a bunch of anti-war activists who were basically, they were working people, they were teachers, they were sick of seeing their kids going to Vietnam, and what they did is they broke into an FBI headquarters in Media, Pennsylvania. And they stole the documents out of there that revealed this program, COINTELPRO. And then they leaked it to the media.
Okay.
They leaked it to the media. And then just recently, I want to say like 2 years ago, after the statute of limitations was up, they came out and they said that they admitted they did it when there was nothing they could do to them. Yeah. So there's a couple good documentaries on that, and there's a couple good YouTube things on that you can see, but it was Media Pennsylvania. FBI office that these guys they broke into, and we wouldn't even know about COINTELPRO because who knows if that would have ever been declassified. You know, the only reason we know about it is because, you know, these anti-war activists.
Another thing I wanted to mention here too, Sean, before you go, I believe there was another, because going back to Ray, I think on his trial it was coming up in the 90s, because I remember you talking about William Pepper and then talking about his last you know, his last trial and everything like that. But I want to say HBO, I think, because that was coming up to a 25th anniversary of the assassination in 93. I'm pretty sure HBO was trying to televise that. I don't know if they did or they tried. I would have to look that up, but they were really pushing to try and televise that 1993 case for Ray. I do remember that, because now that we're talking about, like, Judas and the Black Messiah, these movies, these documentaries, I believe HBO had their hand in something, too.
I think they were. I think you're right on that, Matt. You know, I think you're right. But you know, Martin Luther King's family came out. They didn't, you know, at the end, they didn't believe that Ray was guilty either. Obviously, you know, and that's why they
so at the end of the day, it comes down to, is this it's a government conspiracy. The government did it?
There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. It's, you know, who do you put the blame? Ultimately, was it Hoover? Was it Helms? Was it Dulles? But it comes back to the same thing. It was just the same thing with JFK and RFK
so
all over again.
It could have been
it was an intelligence operation, just like, you know, the other assassinations. There were intelligence ops.
Wow.
You know, and this, again, this isn't me saying this. This is a civil trial, documented evidence, you know, that the media is obviously not going to tell you.
Yeah, but, you know, you have the scary thing about a conspiracy like that is that you have involvement from your executive branch. You're talking FBI, you're talking CIA, you're talking about intelligence agencies. I mean, the Memphis police by itself. I mean, but there's others. I mean, business owners. Here, you have a bar owner, a tavern owner, the firehouse. I mean...
Well, again, if you're going to take a stand on something, you're going to make a lot of enemies.
Sure, right. You know?
You know. But again, we also got to remember that a lot of this evidence that's coming out is from detectives that were good detectives that wanted on record, you know, black operators that wanted it on record. You know, there was a lot of good people that you can't just, you know, I don't want to label the entire FBI, CIA.
Sure.
Them, you know
sure,
what I mean?
Absolutely.
There was a lot of good people here that wanted the truth out and told the truth at the trial.
Wow.
So I think we're going to wrap it up with that.
Okay. That sounds good.
That's about all me and Nate have, but I want to thank you guys for...
Definitely.
Yeah, thanks for coming back. We always appreciate it, and you're welcome back anytime.
We're going to have to get you on more frequently there, Nate. It was definitely nice meeting you, and definitely nice having you on for first time on the podcast show.
All right, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yep, great job. Great research.
And before we go, we just want to let our listeners know that our... lottery giveaway for Toys for Tots is still rolling. Matt has still sold the top number of tickets so far.
Boatload of tickets have been sold, yes.
So just remember, if you guys want to participate, contact Matt and myself either, you know, through if our phone numbers, if you have them, or our social media, or you can just shoot us an email at garlicjarmedia@gmail.com.
Yep.
And we're going to raise as much money as we can for Toys for Tots.
It's looking pretty good, too.
Good. I'm very touched by how many people have already participated. So
it's very overwhelming.
It's a great fundraiser for us.
Yep.
So we always want to try and give back. And thank you, everybody, for sticking along this journey with us. We appreciate every listen, share, like, follow, recommendation that you guys can give us. So thank you for keeping up our momentum here. And we will see everybody on the next one. And her head went round and round. Ooh, she thought I was okay. But he stepped off that train with a high and a pickle and a key.